our small group of mostly regulars today. Good to see you all. And we have a short agenda today, but that has caught us off guard earlier in the last few meetings, so I'm not going to make any pronouncements about how I expect this to be a short meeting just on account of the agenda. Let's begin with public hearing on House Bill 2999. And Dick, while you're giving us the staff summary on that, why don't we bring up Paul Romaine and Pickles.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. House Bill 2999 allows motor vehicle fuel dealers, and these are gasoline dealers, they're not used fuel dealers, to receive upon application a refund of fuel tax paid under certain conditions if the dealer has received less than full consideration from the purchaser. So if the fuel is sold and the dealer does not is not paid for that fuel and is not paid in fuel in full.
Oh, we're bartering.
They're eligible to apply for a refund. The account must have been declared uncollectible by the dealer following federal standards for determining deductibility. And only one refund is allowed per purchaser. So if you trust somebody and they burn you, you can't keep trusting them and keep getting refunds. If partial payment is received before the write-off, the tax refund is prorated, and if some of the debt is collected after the refund has been paid, the dealer must pay the prorated tax to the Department of Transportation. Directs the department to adopt rules governing the refund process and takes effect January 1, 2004.
Okay. Thank you very much. Paul Romaine, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. With me is Cliff Olson from the Mark Nelson Oil Products, and no, it's not the lobbyist. He is only involved in lobbying, not
it's
in oil.
It's the MNOP trucks.
MNOP trucks. You see running down the highway. Cliff is also the legislative chair for the Marketers Association and can answer any questions that might be reasonably technical in nature because I have no technical knowledge, as most of you know from previous experience. The bill, first of all, let me throw out a compliment. The Department of Transportation has been absolutely wonderful to work with this year. You have not had the pleasure of having a lot of their stuff, but they came to us with a number of requests. We came to them with a number of requests, and we've been working extensively in the Transportation Committee with them. They've been absolute wonderful folks to deal with. We go over our complaints, they go over their complaints, we revise the stuff, go back and forth, and we've come out with some very good legislation. Most of it's gone through the system already. This bill passed out of the House Transportation Committee. It's here to you on the second referral, and we would like your support on it. What happens is that a dealer like Mark Nelson Oil Products or some other company will purchase the gasoline at the terminal. We pay the tax to the state at that point. We then go out and deliver it to the gas stations that are out in the hinterlands. And they generally have to pay for it the next month, by say the 15th of the next month after delivery or 30th or whatever. And if they don't pay us, what they've done is they've already sold the gasoline to the public. They've collected the tax on it from the public. And if they don't pay us, we are out not only what the fuel costs, but we're also out what we've already paid the state in the tax for that fuel. What this allows us to do is get a refund on that tax only the tax. Last year, we estimated that the amount would be about $50,000 of the over $1 billion in fuel tax revenue that you collected. That's not a big number to the state, but that is a huge number to the small jobber who's delivered the fuel out there. We sort of perform a state service by delivering it to these outlying areas because they don't get direct delivery from the manufacturers. They're not going to come in to pick up their fuel on their own. So we would appreciate your support for the bill. Cliff, do you have any corrections of my testimony? Or
Just one small one.
Okay.
Cliff Olson, Mark Nelson Oil Products. Actually, the payment is a little bit quicker than that. In most cases, it's usually load to load for 10 days. So the liability is reduced in that case, but it can still happen. We've had people that we had no knowledge that they were in any kind of problem that have taken a load of fuel, have within that 10-day period gone out of business and left us hanging with it, even though we've gone through the complete, you know, credit process. We have set up all those safeguards, and that can happen, especially in this economy that we're dealing with at this point in time.
Okay. Questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Maybe I don't understand the process here. I thought that you had to pay for the fuel when it was delivered. You're buying on credit? Is that what I'm
selling
hearing?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, we're selling on credit. We buy the fuel.
Okay.
At the terminal. We pay the tax at that point.
But you're selling.
And then we go out and we sell it. We deliver it, and they have 10 days. Sometimes it's the next month. It depends on who's doing it. But to collect. And
okay.
We've sold it. We paid the tax. The ultimate end user is the one who's responsible for the tax. You, the consumer who's driving the car, eventually will pay that fuel tax.
Right.
Well, that... Yes, gas station has sold it to you. You've paid the tax and for the fuel, and then that gas station has not necessarily paid. That's the portion that we're talking about.
Okay, I let's follow up.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I guess I don't understand why you sell on credit.
Chairman Federley, Vice Chairman Berger, there's actually a couple, three different ways that the fuel is sold. In some cases, it is cash. If the person's credit is not sufficient, then we would sell to that station on a cash basis. The driver usually picks up a check, a certified check, when he drops the load off. In some cases where the credit has been deemed to be creditworthy, we'll give them load to load, which means that they have until the next load comes in to pay for the previous load. In other cases, there may just be set terms. So there's several ways that this process takes place in the system when it's paid. So that's kind of what the discrepancy is there. But there are some that are COD, yes.
And if I might, mm-hmm. Representative Shetterly, Representative Berger, there's a number of stations, smaller stations, outlying areas that aren't going to be able to pay for the fuel. They're sort of marginal operations, and basically you're trying to get the fuel out to these folks. Then they collect the money from you, the consumer, and then they have the money to pay for the fuel. So they're sort of living on the credit that we're giving them. And part of that credit that we're giving them is not only our potential liability, which is the fuel cost, but it's the state tax that we've already paid in effect on their behalf. And so all we're saying is if we can't collect that state tax from them, that portion of it and that portion only is what we're asking for a refund on. And again, it tends to be a very small number.
And then the next step is if you do after that collect,
we have to pay.
That's right. Then you have to remit that tax portion
right.
back to the Department of Revenue.
And we still have an incentive to go after these people because the lion's share of the cost of this is not the 24 cents to the state. It's the huge amount that the fuel is costing us in the first place.
Sure.
So we have a great incentive to go after these folks, and we do. But every once in a while you end up with somebody in bankruptcy or just gone. And again, last year, which was a very bad year, you ended up with about $50,000 in this. And this applies to gasoline only.
Okay. Any other questions for either of these witnesses? Was there any opposition to this testimony in opposition in the Transportation Committee?
Mr. Chair, there's no testimony in opposition. There was one opposition vote, and that was from Representative Mabry, who did the exact same question that Representative Berger had, which is why do you sell it on credit?
Mm-hmm.
and a very legitimate answer that was answered actually by Representative who was at Greenwick, who came to our defense and basically said that we are performing a service out there by getting this stuff out to various folks in the communities, and it is the state's it's the state tax that we're asking for back, nothing else.
Okay.
So that was the only vote against it.
All right. If no further questions, well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Does anybody else want to speak on House Bill 2999? Dick, I see a revenue impact. Just for clarification, that is not a general fund revenue impact. That's a highway fund revenue impact.
That is correct.
Okay.
And it's also a guess.
Well, I understand that. That's a given.
Come on, Dick. There's got to be a regression analysis on that one, right?
You know, there's no. That's why I call it a guess.
Representative Farr.
You ready for motion, sir?
I move. Oh, I'm sorry. We're not in work session yet, but if we're ready, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2999 and open a work session if the committee is comfortable with this. I'm happy to move it. If somebody would rather wait, we can do that. Let's just see where we are. Representative Farr, you want to move 2999?
Yes, I move House Bill 2999 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Farr moves House Bill 2999 to the floor with a due pass. Is there discussion on that?
Mr.
Chairman. Yes, Representative Farr.
I guess that I have a little problem with it. In that they've chosen to do business that way. In other words, they've chosen to sell to the retailer, who then in turn maybe doesn't pay them. So here we're giving a refund to a business that has actually chosen to do business that way. Right?
Well, in defense, Representative Scott, do you want to go ahead. You go ahead.
I think they have chosen to do business that way, but in the same token, I think that as testimony showed, they're trying to provide a service to get the product to remote areas and maybe more isolated areas that probably are the ones that have more difficulty. And in addition to that, they are taking the substantial reduction if they can't collect their funds in the form of the fuel that they paid for, that they don't get to try and recoup unless they collect it from whomever they issued the credit to.
Representative Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spend a lot of my years as a purchasing agent buying wood products and building materials, and I never once during my days purchasing didn't buy on some form of credit. It's kind of standard operating procedure in the retail, the wholesale to retail industry. I can think of very few cash. I can think of one.
Yeah.
where cash is required. And there are lots of reasons for it. A lot of times there won't be perhaps an employee of the retail outlet that is able to handle their cash to pay the deliverer. So it's pretty standard. 10 days, 30 days, whatever it may be. It's just something that you see in the wholesale to retail transaction.
And while I take Representative Berger's comment, Mr. Olson, do you want to come up? I have one question for you. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to comment that this system serves the state very well in that the taxpayer here is the person at the pump. But we collect our taxes really early in the stream, if you will, and that simplifies the process a lot for us as a taxing agency. And then that tax burden is passed on to the pump, and then it comes back this way. I would hate to think of the complications and difficulty if the gasoline dealers weren't willing to take this on at the first spot and we had to go and collect at the pump directly. Do you understand what I'm saying in terms of the collection of this tax stream? So in a way, this really suits us, but they take this risk, and I think it's minimal.
Well, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the thing that I'm thinking of is that for the honest person, they buy it, they pay the taxes. The tax has already been paid to us. But what we're doing really is making up for people that don't want to pay their bills.
Either don't want to or can't. I guess that's what I wanted to ask you, Mr. Olson. What is a delivery cost? Let's say if you're delivering to Coquille, to a service station in Coquille, what's likely going to be the whatever the invoice or the cost of that delivery, fuel and tax included? What are we talking about in dollars?
Federally, we're looking at right now a full tanker load into that area with freight and everything would be somewhere in the neighborhood of about probably $15,000 to $16,000.
Okay, so that's the cash that they would have to have available to pay up front.
That's correct.
On delivery, and that's what you're extending on credit. They receive the delivery, they sell the gas from that. Then, assuming the way the system designed to operate, then they find they pay off the delivery with the proceeds of the gas that they sell.
That's correct. And in a lot of cases, they would not have that much cash available,
right.
Because obviously they're banking it. In today's economy, a large portion of that is being done in credit cards. And the credit cards, of course, they don't have any cash for that at the site. So it becomes a real burden on them to try to have that amount of money available at the service station. And also a lot of deliveries are made in the during the night, which is a safety issue. The trucks are off the highway. They can drop without blocking any lanes or anything else, so you'd have to have an attendant down there at 3 o'clock in the morning with $15,000 worth of cash to hand to the driver, which creates a lot of safety issues as well.
Representative Barnett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding of this issue is that whatever the payment arrangements are, the fuel is actually used in vehicles on the highways and roads and streets, and that the expenses to the state, which the tax is designed to defer, are actually incurred. Is that whether the fuel is ultimately paid for by the station or not? Isn't that correct?
I suppose that's true. Okay. Anything else?
Yeah.
All right. Well, if there's no further discussion, I get a sense that I'm not sure where you are on this thing yet.
I'm okay with it.
You're okay with it. All right. Well, let's go ahead and call the roll then.
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Berger? Aye. Barr? Aye. Hoskin? Aye. Scott? Aye. Berger? Aye. Williams? Aye. House Bill 2999 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. You picked up your obligatory no vote in this committee as well. And we need a carrier. Somebody want to carry this?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Scott. Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2999. Let's go to public hearing on House Bill 3, Senate Bill 327.
Okay. And then,
wherever you want to be. Wherever you want to be.
I think I'll just stay at
okay, the you bet. That's fine. Mazin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mazin Matic, Legislative Revenue Office. I might say at the beginning of the session, our passion was urban renewal. By this time, I think it's enterprise zones.
There you go.
And this Senate bill passed the Senate Revenue Committee. It's past the floor. It comes as an amended language in the enterprise zones, the non-urban part of the enterprise zones. It primarily changes the requirements for a zone to qualify, or an area to qualify, county, for that designation. Previously, the county needed to qualify for the unemployment of previous year and relative to the state unemployment. This Senate bill changes that, and there is a sense of what would have happened if those changes are not in place, as this bill would do. I've attached in your packet a matrix of what currently is designated and what would the eligibility be. That will be the second column if this bill doesn't pass. And you could see at the bottom that the numbers go from 30 cities or 30 areas to 18. And this is caused primarily by the automatic change of qualification because of the rise in the statewide unemployment rate relative to the rest of the counties, which meant that a county that was chronic for a long time with unemployment, everybody else is chronic at this point, it seems. And therefore, that kind of reduces the eligibility as it stands. This bill will bring back those areas into eligibility. In addition, it adds seven new areas. And this, just the last thing I would like to mention about enterprise zones, I put a background in the staff measure summary. This is the long-term enterprise zones. There are 17 enterprise zones designated by the Economic Community Development Department. Those enterprise zones go for the longer exemptions, 7 to 15 years on property taxes, and they also qualify for income taxes with the approval of the governor above a certain threshold of income. It's a program that also measures the numbers of employment and the level of compensation for that employment for those zones. And it also distinguishes between small areas of 10,000 people and fewer versus 40,000 people and fewer. So in a way, that still obligates us to look at what would have happened under current law if this had passed and reduced it to the 18 zones, and what would happen if the bill passes and pushes it to the 37 zones. And looking at that, we see about $1 million swing either way because of whether leave it as it is or pass the bill.
Okay, Representative Verger.
All right, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Joanne Berger from District 9. Senate Bill 327 passed the Senate and now comes to you for consideration. You've gone through enterprise zones recently and about technical fixes, and that's actually what this is. There's a requirement that the county's employment rate must be 1% higher than the year before or 50% higher than the state unemployment rate in order for certain business firms to qualify for long-term enterprise zone property tax exemption. If you will recall the coalition, the leaflets that have been dropped to you, the enterprise zones is one of the things that is looked on in favor as economic stimulus. And one of the reasons for that is that when people in business are qualified to be in an enterprise zone, there are a lot of things that go along with that. They have to make a minimum investment. They have to hire a certain number of people. In this case, it would be at least 75 full-time employees. And so you can definitely have a nexus from enterprise zones to jobs. There's not a thing there. We brought this bill because the problem in Coos County was one that has happened, if you notice on your list, that's happened to 18 other counties, and that is the state unemployment began to rise. And in our area, our unemployment rate stayed the same. So we began to lose that ratio to the state unemployment. I believe that you'd have to have 11.1 to be 50% higher. So actually, to have 11.1 unemployment rate for our counties, we could see all of our counties not being able to have enterprise zones. So what this does is it just simply eliminates this requirement and makes that fixed so that the enterprise zones and local governments can move ahead with putting businesses in these zones and creating jobs.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hess.
I can see this problem, but it's really just because the rest, the state gets worse relative to Coos Bay. Coos Bay isn't as bad off, relatively speaking, because Portland is the valley's problem. And so I understand and support Representative Berger's bill. My question, though, is why was this, or shouldn't this be folded into the big banana of enterprise zone updating?
Well, I imagine this was created in 1997. You know, Doris Penwell is in the audience.
Okay, come on.
And I think she would be able to explain that criteria. And
that's kind of I was thinking along the same lines. Do we need conforming amendments to any of the other bills that we're looking at dealing with enterprise zones to make sure this all works together? I don't know that we necessarily need to fold it in, but I want to know, if we pass this, do we need conforming amendments to some of the other bills we've been looking at?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell. I'm from Economic and Community Development Department. I'm not the enterprise zone expert, but I think I understand this particular bill and how it relates to the whole program. First of all, this is to the long-term enterprise zone provisions, not the regular 3 to 5. A year enterprise zone program. So these definitions that are in this particular bill only relate to that very small part of the whole enterprise zone program for rural and chronically distressed areas. It is true that this bill should be looked at with House Bill 2299, which is up before your committee again next Monday, I believe. It does not change the same subsection in the statute, but it is another area that has been amended along with some other provisions in 2299. So it might be helpful if you looked at this provision with the other amendments that are in 2299 to be sure that policy-wise you agree with the whole scheme. There was a little bit of a change in House Bill 2299 with the long-term enterprise zone program that I believe had to do with the changing the level of investment, the minimum level of investment that a company had to make in some of these real chronically distressed areas. So, but this provision here just gets rid of the short-term problem we've got with the high unemployment everywhere, and I think Representative Berger is correct that it almost makes it impossible to get to that threshold.
Okay, thank you. What I might be inclined to do, if it's okay with you, Representative Berger, is to defer action on this bill today and ask Ms. Penwell if you could have
have
folks at Economic Development look at this and 2299 and imagine we could bring those back up together. Is that Monday?
On Monday.
Let's put this back on the calendar for Monday so that we have a chance to see them side by side, and if we need amendments to one or the other, we can take care of those at once. But in any event, then we'll have the big picture in front of us with these two bills.
Okay.
Satisfactory?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else want to speak on Senate Bill 327? Okay. Well, it's good to see a Senate bill. It's nice to know they're working down there. We don't have many.
We're having a couple tomorrow.
Well, a couple tomorrow. That's what I mean.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, I'm confused, but my recollection is that revenue measures are supposed to start in this house.
Oh, you know, but there's more than just revenue-raising measures. There's other things to do with the revenue system. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 327. and go to a work session on House Bill 2747 and invite Representative Ringo to come forward. Committee, we've got some amendments I think we'll look at today. My intention would be to look at the amendments, and if there's approval in the committee, take action on the amendments. I think we'll not move the bill out today, but I'd like to have it all ship-shape and ready to go. We talked about that yesterday, I do believe. And so with that, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Welcome. Chair. Senator Charlie Ringo, District 17. I would like this bill to be ship-shaped, too. I spoke with most members of the committee to find out where people were and what would make them comfortable with it. And at the request of Representative Farr, I asked for a specific exemption relating to the wood products industry or the timber industry. Industries engaged in that. And if you look at the dash 4, you'll see those amendments. And at the request of Representative Scott, his specific concern was the vehicles that might be used in the construction industry or construction trade. So I've asked for that exemption to be specified as well. So both of those exemptions are set forth in the A4s, and so I believe that satisfies the concerns. The only other thing I would mention, Mr. Chair, is that the goal of this really is to reduce the financial incentive that would encourage people to buy the largest SUVs who don't really need it. And to that end, I would encourage the committee to adopt the dash 3s. And I do understand that you want to let this bill mellow for a little bit, but I would encourage the committee to adopt the dash 3s and the dash 4s.
Dick, the revenue impact that we looked at when we heard this bill, was that, I forget, the dash 3 or dash 2 revenue impact?
Dash 3 right here.
That would have been...
Or was it the bill as it came over?
Essentially the dash 2. The bill as it came over, really, yes. Which would have been the same as the dash 2.
Yeah.
But I don't think the dash 2 ever actually got before the committee. The revenue impact, Dick Yates with the Legislative Revenue Exchange. The revenue impact on the original bill for the 0305 biennium was $800,000. My estimate with the dash 3 amendments or the dash 4, either one, is a 50% increase in that revenue impact. That the penalty is three times as large, but I'm assuming it does have a significant impact on causing people to buy lighter vehicles, essentially. So that impact for the 0305 biennium on the dash 3 or 4 amendments would be $1.2 million.
Okay, instead of the $800,000 you'd reflect in your... Okay, discussion. Representative Barnhart?
A question, and that's assuming if we did not adopt the bill, your assumption would be that there would not be an increase in the sale of these vehicles, or are we assuming that there would be without the bill when you get to those revenue numbers?
Well, if you're dealing with current law, the sales are unaffected. They are whatever they are.
I got you.
And if you buy the larger vehicles, you get a very large depreciation allowance, and Oregon is tied to that provision. In federal law, you get a very large depreciation allowance or expense. And Oregon is tied to that, so you would get it on the Oregon return. And what this bill says is, first, you disconnect from the federal law, so you don't get it. Secondly, there's an addition on the Oregon return where you have to take what you deducted on the federal, multiply it by 3, and add it back to the Oregon return. And that 3 factor is intended to essentially neutralize the incentive which is granted by the federal government.
I guess the point I'm trying to get at, and I don't know whether this is true or not, is that if we don't pass this bill, and if the one of the results of that is that there's an increased sale of these kinds of vehicles, the loss to the state could be a whole lot more than $1.2
million. Chair. That's correct, but that's current law.
Correct.
So
right, I got you. I now understand the point. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, and again, I guess the point is, coming back to this whole thing, we're dealing here with a federal depreciation allowance that was designed for vehicles used in trade, business, and
Specifically agriculture.
Specifically agriculture, that's where this came from for ag.
Right.
And now, just by the evolution of the market, both on the production end and on the consumer end, I think especially if we adopt the A4s where we leave in the allowance specifically for ag and construction, we're probably really just getting at then the doctors and lawyers and dentists and accountants that live in the West Hills and commute in their SUVs to the parking garage downtown.
My constituents, Mr.
Chair. Mr. Chair.
Not mine. For whom we assume that the allowance is probably never intended.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I'd also point out there are probably some engineers on that list.
Probably too. So. Mm-hmm. Probably some engineers, yeah.
Mr. Chair? Okay.
Yeah, Representative Hess.
I'm very supportive of the Dash 4s, and I think now that these exemptions have been carved out for ag and construction, if we don't do this, we have this policy incongruity in our laws in that we give a credit to incent people to buy hybrids and electric cars, and yet then we also have this, on the other end of the spectrum, an incentive for people to buy these SUVs just for the tax breaks. And I think passing this would sort of reform or straighten out our policy to do what we clearly wanted to do.
Okay. Dick, you're puzzling over something.
I'm trying to decide whether you can adopt just the four or whether you need to adopt, if you want to pursue this line, both the three and four.
Yeah. Four and four. Well, I do the threes and fours. When I appeared last time, I came with the dash twos or the threes, although I think I neglected to bring a copy of the twos. But I think you have to do either the two or the three plus the four.
My feeling is that Dexter can make one set of amendments, and you need to adopt them both. And that's consistent. We will be able to put them together in one amendment.
I'm happy to do that. When I met with Dexter on this last week, he wanted to do it differently, and I deferred to him. But I have no preference how we do the amendments.
So you're thinking for some reason that there's a conflict if we adopt the threes and the fours?
I do not now think so.
No. Oh, you do not now think so. Okay. Okay. So that we move them together, they can be melded into the bill. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I just came watching the door because having uttered the word Dexter literally results in this magical appearance. So.
Kind of like Elijah at the Seder. Don Schellenberg, you found your way to the Revenue Committee this morning. As long as you're here, we'll make use of you. A nod will be sufficient, but you obviously are concerned about the ag exemption in this. You're just watching to make sure that gets in. Okay. You had this question I asked Mr. Romaine in a bill that came earlier to us this morning from the Transportation. Was there any testimony in opposition to this in the Transportation Committee?
Okay. No, actually the only potential opposition was Mr. Schellenberg, because at the very first version we did not have the farm exemption.
Right. Okay. And I think this came out unanimously to us from the Transportation Committee?
That it did.
Okay. Well, committee, what's your pleasure? We could do one of two things, or more than that, I suppose, but we could move the threes and fours this morning and let the bill sit, let Dick do an updated revenue impact statement for us, reschedule the bill probably sometime next week to look at moving it out after we've had a chance to discuss it, or we can wait to take any action until next week. I'd be comfortable in moving the threes and fours if the committee is ready to go, but I don't want to push everybody faster than you're ready to move. You okay with that? Then let's have a motion.
Mr. Chairman,
ooh, you're coming in from all over. Representative Hass, was that you?
Yes.
Okay. He won the foot race.
All right.
I move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2747.
Representative Hass moves adoption of the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2747. Is there any further discussion on those? Any objection? None? Representative Verger, do you want the next set?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the dash four amendments to House Bill 2747.
Okay. Representative Verger moves the dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2747. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? Okay, the A4s are in. Like I say, then we'll put this back on the calendar for next week, fall, and for getting it out there.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. With that, committee, we are done early today. After the prediction, we managed to do it. Close the work session on House Bill 27, House Bill 2747, and we are at adjournment.
Stay profile.